Joe Glazer, we're here at American Music City Vintage. Did I get the name right?
Music City Vintage.
Music City Vintage. Music City Vintage Guitars. This is my new favorite guitar store. This place is incredible.
Well, it is the most accurately named facility possible.
Of everywhere in Nashville, you can't get more well-named than this.
In Music City.
This is a great collection. Joe Glazer on the couch today. How you doing, sir?
Great.
Thanks for taking the time.
Good day. Well, thank you for inviting me.
So we've heard the story of the lost Paisley from Brad Paisley, who has told the story. Mm-hmm. What was your involvement with the guitar?
Well, you know, other than being a Fender nut and a guitar nut, and having gone through my whole my own personal evolution of was Paisley cool or not cool? I'm talking about the finish, not the guy. My involvement was that I kind of liked the way the original pink ones deteriorated. Never liked the any of the reissue stuff, and never thought about it beyond that. I was at a party at a NAMM show talking to a random stranger. No, not a random stranger. A guy I knew. We probably were talking about Brad, and whatever we were talking about, we were talking about the fact that there might have been other Paisley colors. That cling foil. My mom had used cling foil to put in the pantry at one of our houses. She didn't use the Paisley pattern. She used this flower pattern. Right. And I vaguely remember that in retrospect. We were talking to this guy. Goes, well, you know, I found a roll of blue Paisley in a trash can. I said, no, what? He goes, yeah, it was at a garage sale. I asked the woman if I could have it, and she goes, no, if I could buy it. She goes, no, but you can have it. I said, is the same thing? And he goes, yes. And I said, it was the blue, because we'd been talking about the fact that blue would look lovely. And he said, yeah. And so I started trying to lobby him into letting me see it or handle it or send it to me. And I promised him that I would take care of it and send it back, which he didn't do, and I wouldn't have done if I was in his shoes either. And that sort of went in the back of the mind. And then at one point, I think I told Brad about it. At one point, it got mentioned by a guitar builder that somebody had found some blue Paisley paper and contacted him about making a blue guitar for himself, and maybe there would be enough for Brad. And we all talked at that point, and I followed up on it aggressively.
It was the same guy?
Nope.
Different guy.
Nope. Yeah, the first guy wasn't a guitar builder, but he was in the music business. Yeah. And neither of these guys have names, amazingly.
What are the odds?
So I followed up. Brad said, let's get some of that no matter what. If it's $4,000, let's get some of that. And so I followed up immediately with the guitar builder, who told me that the guy changed his mind, and to get it off, he had to use a hair dryer or something. It would be ruined and not usable. It's like, wah, wah, wah. You know, so I started watching, and this was probably 2022 or something, maybe even earlier than that. So I started watching eBay and Etsy and Facebook Marketplace every day. I'd come home, you know, sit, collapse in a chair, and like some sort of weird, obsessed, neurotic, pull those three things up. Paisley shelf paper, blue Paisley. I don't know why we got focused on blue, or why I got focused on blue. I was looking for the blue or the green. I thought that'd be what would be the most beautiful. Anyway, I did this for a couple of years, and finally I got back in touch with the guy from the party and said, do you have even like a couple square inches of it that we could use to try to recreate it? And he said, well, and that just didn't, nothing ever went anywhere. So I just Googled that blue Paisley paper. Most of the time nothing came up, but this forum where somebody had posted about the ammo box popped up again. And I don't belong to any forums. I barely use social media. I consider it to be necessary for business, but an evil, the beginning of the end of the world. But I went ahead and did this, and I found this guy's original listing about having found this ammo box. It said, I bought this box It was $25. I told my wife it was 20. Am I crazy? And all the people responding to it were like, yeah, you're an idiot. You're crazy. And so I told Brad about it, and we assumed, we knew ammo box, blue paper, that this was the one that the guy that we had been talking to, the builder, when he went back, it was already gone. That's what he told us. He said it was already gone, too late. And so I asked Zach, because everybody likes Zach.
Zach Childs.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Zach Childs. Everybody likes him. He's, you know, and he's a known figure. I said, why don't you reach out to this guy and see if we can get even a scrap, if there's something laying around. And so Zach contacted him, and a month went by, no response, 6 weeks. And he's like, okay, that there goes that too, you know. And so then out of the blue, the guy responded, and he said, yeah, I'm still sitting on it. I tried to get two people to make it for me, one a guitar builder, who was the guitar builder, and the other Fender. Fender said they wouldn't use outside materials, which I totally understand.
Why?
Because say you use some outside materials and something goes wrong, any big company looks at that as just a liability. And to do it for one guy who wants to use his own paint, or, you know, people want you to, when I built guitars, I built sort of Tele knockoffs. And every now and then somebody would want to send me a piece of wood to make a guitar out of. And the downside of it was that if there was anything wrong with it, if there was anything that was, you know, it wasn't dried, it warped, it's on you. It's on you, the builder. So I understand why Fender absolutely wouldn't do that.
But, you know, is it surprising that they didn't have some interest to look at the paper, even if they weren't going to build a guitar out of it or to analyze it or something?
You'd think so. But the problem with corporate imagination is that...
Yeah, tell me about corporate imagination, Joe.
Let's say you're a singer-songwriter and you move to Nashville and you're good. And you go in and you meet some producer or some label, and you go in and you go, hey, I'm good. Here I am. They'd rather say, why don't you go back home? There's enough people here already. I don't care how good you are. We've got all we can handle. And so what singer-songwriters face when they get here is they have to go, no. First thing they have to do is say, no, I'm going to do it. You're not going to stop me. And then they have to beat on the door. And they have to make themselves... somebody that at least someone out there can't live without. And it's usually some fans or some other artists. And then somebody at the label, even though labels all pretend like they discovered somebody, it rarely happens that way. Same thing with an idea for a guitar company or something. Because I pitched a lot of stuff at guitar companies, lots of stuff. Their first answer is no. And only if it looks like it's inevitable or somebody else is going to do it. Do they really look at doing it? If they have the idea themselves, if one of the guys working there said, you know what would be really cool, then they'd go pursue it, and they've got the lanes for that. It doesn't work so well for outside stuff, and it takes years to make an idea turn into something, which we found out on this project. Anyway, this guy, Alan Cross, who bought the ammo box, turned out to be, I mean, this was just unbelievable, because he still had the paper. He'd given up on getting something done with it. He had painstakingly taken all these pieces off the box, and there were maybe 30 pieces of the stuff, because there was the strip across the top. An ammo box is like a box with these reinforcement things. These grandparents had done it for their kid and said, Jenny, love from your grandparent. You know, it was written on the bottom. I forget what it really said, but something like that. Anyway, he sent this stuff to us. We were afraid to tell him anything. We were like, just send it to us, and we'll see what we can do. And he said, oh, I would just love it if you'd make a guitar for Brad. And if there was some left over, if I could get one, that would be incredible. So it's like, is this a trick? You know, this is exactly what you want. So he sent it, and when it arrived and we opened it up, it was just beautiful.
What was the texture? What is the texture of this paper, would you say? It's almost hard to imagine when you see it on guitar.
Yeah.
But is it so thin and crinkly, or what is it like?
So it's shelf paper.
Yeah.
So it's thin but with substance, and so when you put knives in the drawer, it wouldn't tear right through it. The way it's made is it's a paper layer, and then there's an aluminum foil layer bonded to it. And what they did was they took that bonded combination and ran it through these giant steel rollers, which I now know all about. And they did this, keep in mind, this was the 60s. This was 1967. And they rolled it through this, and it put it in a variety of different patterns. But the ones that were used on Paisley was a linen pattern, which means it looked like cloth, but with some big threads and some small threads. So in a crosshatch pattern, all we were hoping for. And then on top of that, they did a four-color, basically a screen print, which meant in the factory, they took this paper, this bonded paper, ran it through the roller, then ran it through color number one, laid down the bottom color. Then color number two, they were all four, in this case, four blue colors, of blue-green colors.
Is that why it almost looks 3D?
It is 3D. Yeah. The pink was four pink colors, a green flower. And so all we wanted was enough to try to reproduce it. And it turned out we were hoping if we got something this big. And John Jorgensen, the great and generous John Jorgensen, had a piece of Paisley paper, virgin Paisley paper that Steve Sost, luthier Steve Sost, had given him. It was 2 inches by maybe 5 inches. This is like finding a piece of the Dead Sea Scrolls or something. You're not going to put the whole Bible together out of it, but it's a great start.
Yeah.
Especially if it's been shielded from light all these years, so it's not bleached out. Anyway, this paper arrived, and it was a little wrinkled, and some parts of it were damaged by the glue that had been used to put it on. But like the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found that some of it could be pieced together. The pattern's a 9-inch square, to get technical about this. It's a 9-inch square, and then it repeats. So it's this square, and then the same square, like that. And that's the printed pattern. And the embossed pattern, because that's called embossing, where you roll a pattern into something. That is essentially infinite. I mean, it repeats because the wheels were this big. But it's kind of more at random. Anyway, we took this paper and we made a few guitars. We made the one for Brad. We took the biggest pieces and we found an old 67 body and an old 67 neck. And we figured out how to lay it down. I mean, it was a learning process. And I'm kind of like, we got to look at this painstakingly. And Brad, it's wonderful working with him, because his thing is, everything's going to be okay. That's easy. That's his answer to everything. That's easy. And of course, if you think everything's easy, it's going to be a lot easier than if you don't think it's easy.
It, to me, seems so hard, though, to do this without getting any air bubbles or without having anything wrinkling. You only have one shot, right? So did you practice?
You only have one. Oh, that's the great thing. You only have one shot. You're using basically a contact cement, which means that you put it on the body, and once you roll that paper on, it's on.
Right.
If you missed... SOL.
So you just got on the first try with his blue paisley?
I was sitting there going, we ought to mock this up. We ought to cut something out. We ought to make a pattern. Brad goes, no, it's easy. Let's just roll it on. And we did it. Now, we did it as carefully as possible, considering it was just ad hoc. But it worked out. We smoothed it out. You don't want to rub it too hard, because that flattens the little raised aluminum foil. By the way, the pink is on silver foil. The blue is on gold foil.
Mm.
So it's the same foil, but they put a see-through, a transparent gold down for the blue, and they didn't do it for the pink.
Interesting.
We know so much about this now.
Okay, so you roll the first one out, and then you go, there it is.
That one, and we put the guitar together, and not only did it look great, it was a magical guitar.
Yeah.
Which is, not every guitar is a magical guitar, unless you happen to be sitting in Music City Vintage, where, this is...
We promised that they said if we could record here, we'd give them 5 shout outs.
Okay, well, there's one of them.
So there's two, actually.
But the point is, if you went down the aisle of Tellys here, there'd be a standout, there'd be a 9 out of 10, there'd be, and so you see the whole spectrum. Well, luckily, this one of Brad's that we first put together, because it was a good body, knocking on it and stuff, it's a great guitar. So he immediately liked it, which was great. We took another piece of paper or another thing. We started to have to scrap it together, because the first piece is, the big chunks were like this big. By the time we were ready, the second guitar, it was like this. And you had to actually match the pattern to the pattern.
Right.
It wasn't like you could just take this piece and put it on here. It was a giant jigsaw puzzle. And so the second one was for Alan Cross, who contributed the paper. And it took me 3 or 4 hours at least to get the matches. The great thing about old pink paisley is it cracked where the paper shrunk and pulled off a little bit. So, but there were these natural crack lines, and so we were able to do the piecing so it looked like the natural crack lines, which was great fun. And we got that done, and that also turned out to be great. And then when we had enough left over to do the front side of a third one, which Zach got.
With a Buck Owens coloring book page on the back, right?
And he and Brad, Brad and Zach, when they're together, the most mischievous characters ever. So I did the front. I glued it all on because I wanted it to look good. Brad was like, it doesn't matter that much. It's like, yes, it matters completely. Someday somebody's going to look at this, and if it's not well-pieced, they're going to go,
what a shame.
What idiot did this?
Yeah.
So the front looks good. They did the back, and they just put whatever pieces where they wanted surrounding Buck Owens, and it's the coolest thing ever.
Okay, so then how do you go about recreating the paper for a run of guitars?
So I got on the phone, and I thought, having been surrounded by, oh, it's going to be easy, I started calling these paper companies and researching, you know, looking in Google for a foil-based paper that had a tweed emboss in it. And I found a couple things that looked great, and I ordered them. It turned out the pattern was perfect, but it was on about a 1/10 the scale it needed to be. So it was like looking at the stuff from 4 feet away. It's like, wah, wah, wah. So I called every paper company in this country and other countries and talked to them. And they said, yeah, they don't do that stuff anymore. You know, and Borden, the company that made it, went out of business years ago. They made it in Columbus, Ohio. The Borden company made cling foil. So I finally... And making a new roller, we looked at it, it was going to be $40,000 or $50,000. And you still, if you make this, these rollers are steel. They're that diameter and 4 feet long. They've got the pattern cut into them with this pattern, with this process called EDM, which takes a little spark and goes across and does this, and little by little eats away at it. They might have used acid once upon a time, but to do it would have been incredibly expensive. And we were thinking about doing it. One of the calls I made to was a company in New England, an old company. And when I Googled him, like almost nothing came up anyway. And I was talking to this guy, old brother, you know, he said, me and my brothers. And when he talked about the owner, the CEO, he'd go, yeah, the CEO. And I'd go, you mean your brother, Bob? And he'd go, yeah, the CEO. And it's like, just say my brother.
Yeah, this is a small business is the point. This was a small company.
I was talking to him about this, and I said, could you do this if, you know, do you have any rollers around? And he said, well, we've got some rollers. I'll roll some stuff, but, you know, this is going to be complicated, and why are you doing this? And I said, okay, well, it's been a secret up to now because I told nobody anything. I said, there's a country music artist named Brad Paisley. Oh, we're on speakerphone. He's on there. Go, there's a country music artist named Brad Paisley. We're doing this project. I'm doing it with this country music artist named Brad Paisley. And I got about two more words in. I hear in the background, female voice, Brad Paisley, that's my son's favorite. Blah, you know, it's somebody in the room, some assistant. And so I went through and explained the whole thing. And I said, yeah, if we could possibly, if you know, that apparently had some effect because they got interested in it. They obviously were sitting there going, God, these losers in Nashville want to recreate this paper. It's been discontinued for...
this ugly cling foil that was a bad idea to begin with.
Yeah, the Fender did for as their misunderstanding in 1967 what hippies wanted.
Yeah, right.
And but they poked around, so they rolled us out some of the sample... because they have to take these giant rollers and they have to put them in these big rolling machines and they have to roll this much paper.
What are the rollers? What do you mean?
They're steel.
So steel rollers.
Yeah.
And that's what you were explaining.
They're pressing this into the paper.
They're pressing the design into the, or they're pressing the steel into the paper.
It's like if you took a machine the size of a Volkswagen Bug.
Yeah.
And you had a series of big rollers. I mean, they're this big. They're steel. They're probably a ton each. And you have a rubber roller and then a steel roller and then some more rollers. And you take this giant roller. You've seen them going down the road, these things that are about 5 feet in diameter, and it's a big roll of something.
Yeah.
And they feed it through these rollers. And it goes through, and the roller with the pattern in it, cut into it, presses it into the rubber
That's
or into the female.
It.
That embosses it.
Right.
And then comes out the other end. You look at it. So to mock that up is a giant pain because... unless
course,
they have
yeah.
something sitting in a drawer, they've got to set up all this machine in order to do, you know, 3x3 samples. So they ran some samples for us, and Brad immediately started using this to make test guitars, prototypes and stuff. And it was like, hold on, there's a limited supply of this. And it looked okay, but it wasn't the right embossing pattern. And then one day the guy called me up and he goes, Well, I was talking about the CEO. I said, "You mean your brother?" And he goes, "Yeah, the CEO." And he said that they found some rollers in a room back there that we bought in 1982 from a company that was going out of business. And you might be interested in one of them. And I said, you know, by then I'd had 16 patterns sent to us that weren't even close. I said, yeah, we'll look at another one. They sent it down. It was great. So long story short, I flew up there, spent a day with them, with their color expert, who was a badass color expert. We matched the gold color in our sample of the blue paisley. And gold isn't gold. I mean, we probably made 30 different mixtures of brown and yellow and a little green, a little black. And I spent a lot of time around color. And this is what they do. So they did the gold, and then they just rolled this stuff and they sent it down to us. And that's that. And then we solved the whole printing thing of getting the colors, which also was endless, because you can go to the Pantone color book. You know, it's this thing, this big of little color samples, and go, it's that blue. It is that blue. And then when you print it on whatever you want, or you print it on top of the lighter blue and so forth, it's not going to look like what you want it to.
It's going
to
be different.
Yeah, so you have to go start with what you want and go, okay, it's off by a certain amount of black. Can you add more black? Can you add more yellow? And so you go, we probably did 30 rounds of each color, trying to get each color right, because we wanted it to be perfect. And then we also had to look at creating that pattern. So Nick Druschel at my shop, who's a guy strong in digital arts, and you know, he does all the CNC stuff. So he drew this stuff out based on our samples that we had, moved it around to make it look a little bit more even, so it didn't look like these different boxes. So that, you know, because Brad cared about that, he wanted the squares to fit a certain way. And then we offset the different overlays so that it looked like it was done on a not perfect machine in the 60s, because when they did it, the screen print didn't line up.
Right, of course. Yeah.
So we did all that, and so we've printed it off, and the rest is history. Then we had to go convince Fender that instead of taking 3.5 years, that this could be done in a year, which is done by just pissing people off by going, we're ready. Are you ready? We're ready. And they've been incredible. It's been a total joy working with Fender.
Are you going to do other colors now that you have this kind of secret cracked, or is it just the...
And so working with Fender has been a great third or fourth process, because I've gotten to work with them over the years, and, you know, with a Brett Mason model and stuff like that. So
unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's such a cool looking guitar, especially when you hold... I've held Brad's. It looks 3D, like I was saying, and it plays great, and it's such a great...
It's beautiful. I mean, the pink was interesting.
The blue is incredible.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's when we opened the... We videoed this whole thing because we might do a little documentary or a little book around this. But when we opened it, we took this out of the tube and started unrolling, and it's like, this is psychedelically beautiful. We expected it to be nice, but it was beautiful. So we copied exactly what it looked like. And it is, I mean, you see them side by side, you don't know which is which.
Joe, what are the elements in your, you know, from doing so much guitar building, what are the key elements that make a great Tele?
A great player.
Forget that. That you don't want anything to do with that. That's not going to do anything.
So guitars are looks, sound, and playability. And so we can at least break them down into those three things. Looks is not uncomplicated in that the amount of finish you put on a, starting even with the wood you choose is has a visual impact, but also sound impact. We all love Brazilian rosewood because it has a sound. But when they started using it in the first place, Brazilian rosewood was a wood that was used in furniture and in tables and because it was really a beautiful hardwood, and the idea that it would be the go-to dream wood of the 2000s, the, you know, this millennia, it was not necessarily part of it. So there's the wood. Swamp ash is not an attractive wood. It's just a wood. Telecasters, as made by Fender, were just picnic tables. When I started building guitars in the 70s, Schecter and some of these companies were building these really beautiful hardwood, you know, walnut and zebra wood bodies, and they sounded terrible. They were too hard, too heavy. So Lux has several elements. One, the wood. And secondly, certainly the finish. And what has been realized, I mean, what I think people didn't know when I first started building, and I discovered by accident, was that less finish tends to let a guitar open up. I discovered by accident. I was making a prototype instrument where I could take my Bender, which I was testing, and quickly put it in a guitar and then quickly take it out. And so I made this body and accidentally bought lightweight ash. And swamp ash, by the way, is just ash, but it happens to grow in a wet climate, in a wet location, so it grows quite quickly and is light and thin and soft. So there is no swamp ash other than the ash grown in swamps, essentially. Anyway, I just happened to buy this piece of lightweight ash at the hardware store. It was, you know, 3/4 inch thick. I was putting it together front to back, and it sounded like $1 million. And I thought, well, I'll finish this guitar. So, because I could screw the front to the back, you know, through the pickup holes. And so I finished the guitar and I painted it and, you know, the coffee table finish that was popular at the time, and then put it back together again. And I took it over to Bill Hullett, who's been my Tele mentor over these years. And we played it, and it just sucked. And it's like, I swear, at the house, this was great. So I took it home. I stripped it down again because it was pretty obvious. I changed one thing at a time, which is a great principle.
Yeah.
You change two things, you'll never know what's what. So I stripped it down, and came back to life. So I learned that thin finishes counted. So
thin finish.
Generally thin finish.
Generally speaking, thin finish is the way to go.
Because it's a filter.
Yeah,
and so there's probably some woods that if you put a big, thick, heavy finish on, you're taking that parametric of finish and pulling stuff down. And so when you look at how good the Fender Relics were, which Vince Canetto did, a reason they were great guitars is that they couldn't put much finish on, because if they wanted to torture them, they had to torture them through a thin finish, or they just couldn't do it. And same thing, you know, everybody's talking about how great the Gibson Tom Murphy Labs guitars are, which they are. By the way, I can make jokes about this because I played in a band with Tom Murphy for years. So, no, it's the thin finish.
It's thin finish.
Yeah.
That's what does it.
You make the same guitar. You can put the same braces and everything in something else, but the thin finish is a giant advantage.
What's not needed? Like, I've heard you say that, like, tuners on a guitar, unless they're really, really bad, basically make zero difference. Is that true?
Very few tuners lose tune.
Lose tune.
Yeah, you can put tuners on badly. You know, the relationship between the neck and the body, all these things affect the sound. Pickups, you know, I always tell people that if they're going to buy an electric guitar, go play it acoustically. Go into Guitar Center or wherever you're going to go, or say Music City Vintage, and sit down and play all the guitars acoustically. If they're not good acoustically, don't waste your time buying it and thinking that changing the pickups is going to make a difference, because the odds are not great. It might, and there's a great record that's been made with guitars that don't appear to have any wonderful properties at all. So there's no hard rules. But, you know, if it's not acoustic, if it doesn't sound great, and in terms of Tellys, Vince Gill's main white Telly, that thing just has a voice. Ray Flack's Telly that he had over the years. A lot of these guitars that we've, the one that Robin Ford, that 6061 one, all those guitars were just magic, unplugged, and of course they were magic amplified.
What does it come down to though? Is it mostly the wood, and do the components like the bridge have a minimal effect on
everything affects it. So that was looks. Okay, sound is. If you look at any object, a bell, it has a resonant frequency. And it has either a complex resonant frequency or a simpler resonant frequency. And there are these primary peaks, and then there, as you go up the frequency, they get smaller and closer together. Those change depending on mass, which is weight, stiffness, which is modulus elasticity, and damping, which is how much it absorbs, how much sound dissipates over time. And then there's the interaction of that when you put the control plate on. You're changing all that stuff. If you change the bridge on an acoustic guitar, if you put something of a different weight on or a different stiffness, that guitar is going to sound different. Maybe nobody will hear it. Everything. I mean, if you people are now all wound up about hide glue, which we use in the shop, and we use every kind of glue in its exact right application. No, what we consider is the right application.
That's all that matters, really, right?
It's what we think. Yeah. And what we say. We say this. And I got on the such and such group and said, but glue conducts sound or doesn't interfere with sound. So everything matters. And then playability matters in the sense that what I discovered, you know, I was kind of like the first guy who went on a limb and really put the Plec machine to work. There was a shop in England that was using one, we really went all in on it after I made fun of it for foreseeing it. I was like,
now you're a partner in the company.
I am a partner because once I got to see it, once I got to use it, it was like, okay, me, the know-it-all, was so sure what this did do and didn't do. And actually I was wrong about everything. And that if all you could do was scan a neck and see what was really going on. Of course, you're doing it under string tension. So you see what really is going on. You see what the strings see. And what the strings see is everything. The string is the customer. The player is the partner. And the repair guy is the least important. He's the taxi driver, you know. But all those things matter. And if a string is able to, assuming you use good strings, and we spend a lot of time thinking about what are good strings that our customers like. Because I don't care if a new string company comes along and they're hand wound and they're done in the dark in Finland. If the players here, and that's the great thing about Nashville, if the players don't like it and don't still like it 6 months later, it's not good enough. Yeah. So anyway, we started looking at the difference between the sound of guitars when everything was optimized, even in the fretboard. Truss rod tightness has something to do with the way a neck sounds. We started looking at how all that stuff worked together, and it makes a big difference in sound. So to answer your question 40 minutes later, a Telecaster has its own character. It's impacted by a bunch of stuff. And what I learned building was that you could even use the same piece of wood, a different part of the same piece of wood, the body for this one, for the body for that one, and the same with the neck, but there's enough that changed that you'd get two completely different guitars. Not completely different compared to a solid walnut, such and such, but enough different that you couldn't hand one to a great player in the dark and go, this is the same guitar. You could set it up exactly the same, but you'd hand it to them and they'd go, no, it's a brother, it's a cousin, but it's not the same guitar. So that colors what, you know, every bridge matters, saddles matter. We just rolled out these things called Groovemaster saddles that have Tele saddle. They're saddles with little straight grooves, not what Fender used, which were at an angle, which caused strings to sitar a little bit because the string is hitting one wall of it at an angle. But straight grooves. The way the strings sit in those grooves has an effect on what voices those strings. We didn't sell them that way. We didn't tell people, oh, this is going to be great because they're grooves. Like Robin Ford's Tele, you know, Robin has one of those Teles that has the really micro thread. It's called all thread, but it was a very close thing. And I always thought that those 6061 Teles sounded great. The sound of the string in the saddles. So everything like that.
Everything matters.
Everything matters.
I've seen those Tele saddles, and I thought about putting them on my Tele. I put on compensated saddles probably a decade ago on my main Tele. And I go, I should try these out. But then I go, if I'm not bothered by my Tele, should I mess with it?
I totally agree with you. If things are good enough, they're good enough.
Just leave it.
Might get better, might not be, might be worse.
Yeah.
Because no one thing, what I found when I was building guitars, if I took the ideal body and the ideal neck and the, if it's going to be rosewood fingerboard, the ideal fingerboard and the ideal bridge, I might get something that's a dog. Because it's like... If you're dating and you go, okay, I want a girl, you know, or a girl, whatever your preference is, and I want my mate to be this tall and have this kind of hair and blah, 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 and then you find somebody like that, that doesn't make it happen at all. And you look at the number, you know, I happen to been somebody who dated women, and I talk to women, you know, about And my friends, they say, you're a loser, Joe. Never. No, the answer is still no. No, they, you know, I hear them go, well, you know, I tried online dating. I said, well, what were your preferences? Well, you know, tall, dark, and handsome, head of hair and all this stuff. You look at who they end up with, you know, and it's nothing like that at all. And if that was the way that the world worked, bald guys would all be single, and they're not. And so guitars are the same way. If you plan to play it as opposed to collecting, and I hope we get to talk about the whole collecting world because I'm very interested in that. But if you plan to play it, you got to throw away this idea that looks are going to be something that you can absolutely achieve. Now, you might be like one of these people who only wants to play. I've got a customer who, great, great bass player who plays Sonic Blue, everything. That's her color, Sonic Blue. She's been lucky to find some great Sonic Blue instruments. But if that's the criteria, you're taking yourself down to 10% of something, and that's not a good bet in instruments.
Right, right. I was watching this video of the Opry archives where they all of these instruments archived and everything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and they were interviewing someone, and I was like, oh my God, they're using Gear Check at the Opry to completely archive their instruments and everything. What, how did you come up with the idea for that software?
Well, let's say that a huge part of our, a huge section of our customers, we don't talk about publicly because instruments and collections are quite often secret.
Yeah. So that was on the internet. I found that on the internet. They were being interviewed about it.
Okay. But I'm just saying that if we can talk about Gear Check, let's talk about it without getting into, I can give you some examples. So over, the, so guitars are, well, let me talk about a guitar I have. I collected guitars because I needed a library of stuff to look at. You know, what does the, what is the binding like on a Gretsch, 56 Gretsch, blah, blah, blah. That's sort of untenable because you'd have to have 2,000 or 4,000 guitars to pull that off. We, at a certain point, built something called Gitwick, which is still, it's still in use, which is a photo resource of detailed photos, not just the Google front picture and maybe the back picture, but like 40 or 50 pictures. And it's crowdsourced and it's semi-complete, but it was a big thing. But we started looking at collecting and, well, for instance, the guitar I was going to tell you about. I have Jerry Reed's 56 Tele, and this is the one he played Amos Moses on and a bunch of stuff. And Jerry Reed was, I mean, one of my absolute heroes. You know, James Burton, they're on one hand. And Reed was one of them. And when I was working for him, he got sick of the neck that was on his 56 Tele. He wanted a wider one, and Fred Newell had this Mighty Might neck on. So he ordered six of them. He said, cock. We're going to change his neck out. And so I put this neck on. It was wider and he liked it. And I said, Jerry, what do you want to do with the original, the neck we're taking off? He goes, cock, I don't care. You can smoke it. You can eat it. You can put it where the sun don't shine. And I said, does that mean I can have it? And he goes, do I need to repeat that? So I ended up with the neck. And long story short, he traded somebody else the pickups and I traded them out eventually. And then after he was gone, the body showed up. Chip Young had it on the guitar that we put, you know, that I changed the neck on. Chip Young ended up, had nothing, that had the wrong pickups, the wrong everything, but I got the body. So I've got Jerry Reed's guitar.
You put it back together. You got everything, you put it back together.
I got everything. You know, as Jerry Reed's, so as a 56 Tele with a route in the, a neck pickup route, because he was experimenting on stuff, it's worth, I mean, we could ask somebody here, but it's worth half of what it would have been worth. As Jerry Reed's guitar, that he did all that stuff too. And then there's the story of how I got it and all that stuff. It's worth 5x, 10x that because it's got story. So story is everything. Story is everything. And as we have gone down through at my shop and just the people I know, even with the Plec, we find that anything you have records of increases, is important and increases the intrinsic value of that, but it also increases the monetary value of something. And so a long time ago, we started, when it first became possible to build websites and apps, we started looking at what we then called Vintage Registry, which was something that was a way of putting together a history of an instrument. Where did it come from? Who played it? what work's been done on it, what work hasn't been done on it. And we sort of saw that as being kind of the wristband, the hospital wristband to follow a guitar around. We early on paired it with an RFID tag, which is about the size of a piece of rice that you can, we pull the end pin, the strap button, or we shoot this hole in about 3/4 of an inch, stick it in there. You can't find it in a million years. If you aren't looking for it, you would never know one was there. And if you are looking, it's, you know, it'll tell you that this guitar has an ID. It's just like your dog. You know, if your dog runs up and they happens to have one of these exact same chips, you might get your dog back. But you also might know it's your dog and, you know, so forth. So we built this whole site around collection management. And we've been working with, because the people who care about collections the most are these high-end collectors, and quite often high-end collectors who have a team that kind of works with them. Because if you're a high-end collector and you've got 200 or 300 or something, or you're a museum, you're probably, if you're the owner, you're probably not going to sit there and do the photographs. You're going to have somebody like our photographer today do this stuff.
So someone like Jim Irsay, for example,
would create a full history that's spreadsheet. It's a site. It has the photos. It has the repair history. It has the insurance history. It's got the RFID tag. It's got the generic story of what it is, which is this 56 Tele, they were generally white, a see-through white with white pickguard, maple fingerboard, blah, blah, blah. That's the generic thing. And then the story of that particular instrument. This guitar was owned by so-and-so, was used in this sort of way. And here's its history. And so it's one place to put all this stuff together. It's private. It's secure. I mean, it's extremely secure because privacy matters to people who have things. And it's a way to start to build provenance. You have provenance, but if you're just keeping it up here in your head, or you keep your receipt in your drawer and you happen to live in LA and the, you know, hillside burns down and you're Landau or somebody like that and you're wiped out, you're wiped out. Anyway, so Gear Check it would be very helpful. It would be really helpful to Josh Rawlings, who's done the digital side of this and has been partner in this, is in the building.
Should we bring him in?
Let's bring him in.
Should we bring Josh in?
Because he has a different... I can tell you why it's important. He can tell you more about how it's important.
Should we get Josh on the couch? Let's go.
Would you feel like coming over here talking about this?
What's up? This is cool. This is the other side.
This could be your big break.
Hi, y'all. I know.
We got Josh Rawlings on the couch now.
Good day. Hey, Joe. What's up, y'all? We're talking about Gear Check?
We're talking about Gear Check.
So let me introduce Josh.
Please introduce Josh.
So I run a repair shop, Glazer Instruments, but on the side, we've made parts and tools. We have a company called Music City Bridge. By the way, Music City Vintage, you stole our name. But Music City Bridge, for obvious reasons, because we're in Music City, and we started making bridges, and it just seemed like a bridge, you know, to... And we also have... So we make parts and tools. We make software, and we've got a company called GitSuite that makes software. We make shop management software. We make Gitwick, which I told you was a photo resource. And that naturally, and along with the effect of the Plex data, it got us thinking a lot about this. And so Josh runs the whole parts and tools and software stuff, and that's what he does.
Yeah.
So once is this, how important is this stuff to document? Like, this is your whole thing.
Well, I think I heard you guys cover this a moment ago. The difference between having a story and not having a story could mean tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we've kind of made a mission out of going to high-end collections, these people who have real, I mean, this is like real assets. And if you think about Gear Check as essentially the Fidelity account where you might manage your stocks, but the same sort of place where you'll manage your collection, these things are going to move up and down in value, and that value is going to change based on story. So we'll physically show up to a place and say, these are all the physical things that you own. This is their current status, and this is their current market value. And one of the things we've been able to do, and this wouldn't have been possible even a year ago, is get real-time market data on what the thing's worth today. And so any collector can now look at the range of stuff they have in their Gear Check account, which they've never had before. They've just kept it in spreadsheets or in a file cabinet in the garage that is prone to flooding, fire, and other issues. And we don't need to be reminded about the issue of natural disasters and people never getting paid off for insurance if they don't have it documented. We show up and we document this stuff, and it transforms the collection from something that is opaque and held in one person's head into something that maybe, if there's a death in the family, can be translated to the next of kin. Or at the very least, when these things go up for sale, they have a comprehensive history.
That's the deal.
So you guys show up to these massive collections and you guys actually do the documenting?
Keep in mind, somebody can do this themselves perfectly well.
Right, right.
But it turns out that quite often a white glove process, which we have found to be that people actually appreciate that. That's one of the options.
Yeah.
But can they do it? Sometimes we just show up, like with Steve Earle. We went and looked at the beginning of his collection, worked with him, worked with his guys, going through the steps of photography, of information upload. You know, again, insurance appraisals, and appraisals change over time. So having a history of your appraisal is important. Where we kind of went into this philosophy of what do you want in there, and how do you put it in, and how do you then manage it over time? Do you have a manager? You know, you have an owner of an account who is the owner of the instruments, but maybe they have somebody who manages it for them, who they allow access for a while, and maybe that guy, you know, that person becomes an astronaut and they don't have access after a while. So it just, whatever, we just kind of looked at it thinking about the fact that every collection is important to everybody. But if you start with the ones, when instruments are worth $300,000 or $1,300,000, these are assets. This is an asset class. And it's very important to know what you have, whether you have it appraised or authenticated. Know that that's absolutely done, and know when it happened and by whom. And so this is also, it also is anchored with blockchain entries. So if you take a Martin, for instance, a vintage Martin that has ivory binding, naturally came with ivory binding, Brazilian rosewood. Well, you can't ship this between countries now. Ivory is restricted. At some point, it will be possible to, by establishing the authenticity and the initial manufacturing date, this is getting better and better as access to data gets better, it will be possible to grandfather this stuff in, I would think. And so being able to say that in 2025, this really was ivory, and this is the proof line of why it's ivory, or saying that this mahogany, which is now in 2040 is no longer legal. You know, you can't use mahogany. Well, this mahogany actually dates back to 2025, because better late than never. You know, you can say, well, we really should have done this in the 80s when the technology wasn't there, or we really should have done this in 2015 or 2018 when Joe and Josh first started talking about it. Well, you didn't do it. But now, if you do it, you're at least setting yourself up for having the story and also having the dated protection of when stuff happens. Because everything is about when does the story go back to? You know, there's this famous set of stories about an art gallery in New York that was selling these paintings that came out of this private collection. Nobody wanted to talk about them because it was a secret collection. These guys were buying these paintings, and it just seemed, this guy took it to an authenticator because he just wanted to make sure. He was a dentist. He was like, how did I get so lucky as to buy a Kandinsky and got a pretty good price, and I didn't have to bid against, you know, Andy Warhol or whoever it was. And he took it to the authenticator, who said, well, this is great. It's a wonderful looking Kandinsky. The only problem is that the yellow paint wasn't made till 20 years after the painting was painted. And so the whole thing is going into this direction of what can you prove, when can you prove it, and who said, when, why, how come, and so forth. And so we just built a platform for it.
Is this valuable if you have a collection of guitars that maybe aren't significantly valuable or collectible or vintage?
Depends on what the story is.
Yeah.
So recently, we went and looked at there's a great rock and roll artist who passed away recently.
Yeah.
And he didn't happen to be, some people like expensive stuff and some people like interesting stuff. And he happened to be sort of a beach-oriented guy, and he liked things that sort of represented his life. And he had some really nice vintage guitars, but he also had some things that just represented his lifestyle. And he has this telly, this sort of yellow telly. It's got a palm tree on it. And without him having been the owner, it's $215, you know. Him being the owner, because he has these, this giant sea of fans, and, you know, the who knows what the, you know, I think the family, if they just, for instance, were going to put it in a foundation and do something or donate it to a museum or something, it's the more that it is donated or represented as its story, the more important it is as an instrument. If it got used on, you know, Jerry Reed thing, the fact that I can find some proof of the fact that he used it on Amos Moses changes everything. And so if you don't do it, you know, you can be anybody. You can be, you know, obviously you're not trying to be a session player, but you probably play some music. And say you just went into the studio and played something that turned out to be like Wooly Bully. Suddenly the world rocked around it, even though you never did anything before and you might not plan to do anything afterwards. But here's the guitar that was played on Wooly Bully. That's incredibly important. If you say, well, yeah, we didn't really do anything about it, then you've got that red 335 or 345 that is the Back to the Future guitar that Gibson's making this big, you know, I mean, it's great, great fun. But where that guitar is and really is it, that could have been solved a long time
ago.
How
are they, when they find that guitar, how are they going to authenticate it to know that that's the one? They're going to grain match it with photos of it? Or?
They could. You know, there's various things that prove a guitar is a guitar or that it is as old as it's supposed to be. And that's just getting, I mean, that's obviously the future, because just having a strong opinion is no longer the best way to, you know, I don't go to the doctor and go, hey, it hurts right here. And he goes, well, looks like you broke this bone. Oh, you cracked it there. He goes, I've got this thing. You know, we're going to check it out. And that's the way the world's going one way or another.
How hard is this stuff? Like, you see people pop open tellies, the necks, they'll pop the neck off and like, oh, there's the pencil markings. It's a whatever it is. I go, couldn't someone have just taken a pencil and just scribbled that? Like, why do we trust these pencil markings so much?
We don't anymore.
Really?
Nope. That day of that, if you have something that's been known since 1975, we're right with Dustin Miller and Brian Gallup and Tom Nania, we're writing this book on pre-war dreadnoughts right now. And Martin made about 2,000 of these incredible guitars in the 30s, basically. They made 91, supposedly, D45s. And of course, things happen. You know, a house might burn down, something would happen. So they made 91, and there's only about 148 of them left. And so how does that happen? Starting in the 70s, people started converting D28s to D45s and doing a damn good job. And so the only thing you know is that if a guitar has been at least known since 1975, that it was at least one of the early conversions. Or if there's a photo of somebody in 1940 with it, then it was certainly out of the 30s. So again, story and documentation matters. It matters tremendously.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the one thing I was going to add to this is there's a multi-trillion dollar handoff happening in the economy where the baby boomers are retiring from their gigs. And the way that relates to the musical instrument market is dealers have been the appraisers and the authenticators, and there's a lot of danger in that. There's no other industry where you go buy a house and you ask the sales agent for the house that you want to buy if it's in good shape. And so there's going to have to be institutions and documentation for, hey, this is how you actually appraise and authenticate that something is real, and this is how we're getting market data in a transparent way. Because right now it's coming, and there's just not enough people who are going to be alive in 10 years who are going to actually be able to do this work. And that's a real fact. And part of the work that we're doing is picking the brains of this kind of
brain trust.
Yeah, this brain trust, essentially, and translating their knowledge into something that can be repeatable and consistent. And GearCheck plays a huge role in that. I mean, just one quick aside, which is we're talking about photo ID. Hey, couldn't you use the fingerprint of this grain to do this? I reached out to the foremost expert of photo ID. And what he told me was, you print out a photo of one sample, and you print out a photo of another sample, and you put it under a magnifying glass, and you match the lines up. That's how they do it. That's how the world-class guy does it. And I'm just thinking in the future, that guy is not passing that skill set to the next generation. We're going to have to build technology and systems to deal with this, just like they do with houses, wristwatches, sports memorabilia, every other place where you can get a third party authentication is going to happen for guitars. And gear check plays a role.
And it's not in the future. It's in the very near future. And actually, if you could peel back this isn't paranoia. If you could peel back what any government is using to do surveillance on its neighbors, that's a lot of it is human judgment, but a lot of it is not anymore. And so any of that stuff, will have four or five opinions. Now you can have four or five people do an appraisal. Even in gear check, you can send something off and get four or five appraisals, and you should, because one person's thing won't help you when you go to sell it. If there's a global internet and somebody can reference it and go, well, they sold it to you for $150,000 because they sold it to you. And it's actually really, the history is only worth 71, you know, it's only worth 71,000, and you just took their word because they're so-and-so. But also, if you can, anything that you can pin back to a certain point in time becomes incredibly powerful. And it's up to you to do it. Nobody's going to do it for you, and nobody's going to do it after the fact.
I love it.
Yeah.
What do you look for if you have a pre-CBS Strat come through the shop, it's got zero provenance, what do you look for that you think undistinguishably will mark it as what it is, or will let you know that it is what it is?
You hope there's a family that has a picture of their kid when he was 7 years old standing with it, and then he went off to Vietnam and didn't come back, and it's been the case, and the case looks like it's not been anywhere except out of the bed, under the bed. That's what you hope for. Otherwise, here's the problem. I went to a recent guitar show in another country, and I was talking to somebody about this whole thing of gear check and all this stuff, and he said, appraisers will always have the last role. And I said, well, why is that? And he goes, well, because I know where every little tooling mark ever was on the Fender stuff. I know Fender from 51 to whatever, and I know every single tooling mark, every mark on the, I know every single like that thing. You could not fool me. And I go, well, that's great. Do you do repair? And he goes, yes. And I said, do you do restoration? He said, yes. I said, do you do vintage touch-up? And he said, yes. I said, what if you took a guitar and did what you needed to change it to look exactly like a 1961 Stratocaster, whatever it was that you threw out there, and then you celebrated, you had a drink, you took it to a friend's house, you had a drink, you fell down the stairs, you hit your head, you woke up, you didn't know who you were, that came back, but you didn't know anything about what you've done, and one day that guitar comes into your shop, would you be able to tell that it was fake? And he looked at me, and he rocked for a while, and then he gave me the, I don't like you look, and he walked off. But that's the facts. That is the facts. Yeah. And so you have this race between forgery and authentication. And if you don't document something, you will never, it's just an arms race. It's just like right now what we're going through in the world with the arms race. You know, there's better drones, and now there's better drone detection. There's better, if you don't document something and you don't start as soon as you can, by the time it becomes super important to do so, you won't have any proof that you won't have the proof that would have really helped everything. And nobody's like, so custom color Fenders. People speculate that 40% of them are not original. You can still buy one. You can still like it. You can still enjoy it. But if you're not thinking about instruments as having value and resale value, then you just take it home and you take it down to your room in the basement and you play it and you kind of go, look what I have. But that's separated from selling. And the same thing with stories. If you heard that something belonged to somebody, but if you don't go do a little interview with them and say, hey, I mean, this is what we've done with most of these high-end clients. We sit them down and go, tell us about this story. Tell us about what you know about it, your acquisition, and why you bought it. Why'd you buy this incredible, this beautiful red, rare color Tele? And they tell that story, and that is as much a part of the value of that guitar as the paint, as anything else. And if you look across the art world, you look across the violin world. I mean, there are no original Stradivarius violins. They've all been re-necked. There's one that hasn't been re-necked. People don't buy them. They don't pay $21 million for these things because they're in mint condition. They buy them because Joshua Heifetz or somebody played it because it was used, because it has this history, its history, its story, And if it has a great sound, it's going to have a great history. Beaten up guitars. I mean, here we are at Music City Vintage, by the way, an incredible thing in my same neighborhood. Berry Hill, music capital of the world, where there's 48 studios. Now, if you take the most beaten up guitar in here, it's probably beaten up because somebody really, really loved that. And they really played the dog out of it. And that's a good sign. That's not a strike against it. We're not talking about the Middle East where the only thing of value is a virgin who's never been out of her dad's house. We're talking about things that if you can prove that somebody loved them, you can justify that the reason they loved them is a justifiable reason for spending a lot for an instrument. Keith Richards' favorite guitar is beaten up, but it's worth much more than the one he has that's mint condition, which is just a guitar in mint condition. Peter Frampton, also a neighbor here, he's got a studio right down the street, has a guitar. His famous black Les Paul went down in a plane crash in Venezuela in the 70s and caught on fire in the case. But because it was in a road case, the fire went out quickly. It just ravaged the headstock a little bit. You know, when he found it, he had it brought up here, suspicious of whether it was whether it's the original guitar. And he called me and he called Mike McGuire out at Gibson, and they found parts for it, you know, new tuners and stuff. And I did the restoration. I talked him into keeping everything worn and torn like it was. He said he was at first, he wanted to just get it restored to brand new. And I said, Peter, just think about if we can keep, you know, the laugh lines and the little belly and stuff. And and that's what we did. That guitar is got to be one of these several million-dollar guitars, more so because it now has the thing. He played all those great hits, you know, do you feel, you know, all that kind of stuff. And also it's got the best lost and found story in the world.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We are wrapping up here with Joe and Josh.
All right.
Joe, there's this great story online of Zach Childs and Brad Paisley finding this old guitar in your attic.
Piecing
it together, the whole thing. You say that's the last of the stash. Is that really the last of the stash? Are there any more of those bodies floating around?
Oh, Zach's guitar that they pilfered out of my... The temptation is great to just start making these things that don't exist anymore.
Come on, why would you not do this?
I made a few guitars that people really like.
Yeah,
I had my style, you know, slightly thinner body, bound front,
single binding,
some color, and I had my heyday. And I was lucky in that when I was doing it, there were four people in the world doing that. You know, me and Phil Kubicki, and you know, two or three other people making fake tellies, and you know, I copied Fender. And by the way, made the three pickup so-called Nashville Telly, and Fender copied me. So I consider ourselves that we're even. But no, I think I did. You know, I think you get in, you do your thing, and you get out. You know, and I don't want to be Mike Tyson fighting way past, you know, the point where I shouldn't. And so they went through, my guys did this against my will, and they're going to all suffer at Christmas. No, against my will, they found these necks, and they said, let's just, how do you say no to Brad? How do you say no to Bukovac about the mailbox, you know?
Yeah, I can't believe you gave Bukovac your mailbox, your Van Halen mailbox. Did he pay you for it, or he just walked out with it?
He's going to pay. Let me tell you, he's paying every day.
Every day he's paying.
No, but you know, they put together pretty much the rest of the viable bodies. There were seven or eight bodies, and same thing with the necks. And I'm glad they did it. I'm really glad they did it, but... Building tellies again, not gonna be.
Man,
done.
Yeah, it only took 10 years to be able to get into that stash, by the way. So all good. Thanks to you, man. Thanks for having us on,
guys. Thanks for coming on.
Great,
Joe. Yeah, great to see you. Great to see
likewise,
both of you guys.
Likewise.
Over my microphone, dude. The most awkward handshake ever on camera, right there. We'll have to do it again. There's so much we didn't even cover. We didn't cover anything about Bren Mason and his telly.
No.
We didn't cover anything about Benders. There's lots of that online. You can go find that.
Yeah, there is. And that's a story told. But yeah, I mean, anytime, we're really grateful to be able to tell pretty much not the myth, you know? And so anytime you got a question about anything, you know, it won't necessarily be the truth because it's our opinion. It's my opinion. But you know, I'm a great believer in just letting the story speak for itself.
Joe, I so appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching. See you next time.